That's my problem, Keith, is I feel like I'm coordinated, but just drill bits, there's so much going on at one time that I suspect that if I did it every day, you know, that would be a different story. But, you know, sometimes when you work around men that are women that are, you know, they are skilled at what they do, welders, machinists, and millwrights, and things like that. You sit there and watch them work, and you think, man, that's so easy. I mean, that looks so simple. And then, you come back and you try it, and it's the boogeriest thing you've ever seen in your life. And you've had it in your mind, hey, I saw this guy do this, and it was simple. But when I tried, it's awful. So I learned years ago that, you know, that person who is doing whatever that task is that you thought was simple, he's done it 10 million times. And there is something happening in his brain that you're not seeing. And I have tried to compensate with, you know, drill bit grinders and jigs and da-da-da. And I just have never been successful with it. But my dad is, you know, he's been a welder his whole life. And he's, you know, he's taught me a lot. But Keith, you work in a plant. I got a question for you. Are welders hateful, or is it just in my area?
For Hunter, I think that might be just a regional thing. I have worked some with some at other shops. We've only got one welder where we're at now. He's a pretty good fella. And I've worked at as a defense contractor. We had one of the best welders I ever laid eyes on. Did a lot of aluminum welding and just beautiful beads. We had some of our robots couldn't do as good as he could. But yeah, it's probably a regional thing. I've run across one or two myself.
Exactly. So, like I said, my dad's a retired welder from Hercell and he's, and he's welded, he repaired barges and ships, or PT boats in Vietnam. And so he's, we've always had a welding shop out here. And, you know, but dad could never, you know, do the machining stuff because it's just so expensive. But I'll buy something broken and, you know, spend a little time on it and get it, you know, back into some kind of operating condition. And just kind of built a machine shop out of that. It's taken me a long time because that stuff is expensive. But my whole point of this whole conversation was Dad used to take me over. They have shutdowns over at Hercell and Neath. And, you know, for a summer job, he'd take me over there as his helper. And I'd get to go in the workshop with the other welders and machinists. And, I mean, Lord, you couldn't do that today for insurance reasons and all. But it's just hateful. I mean, just every welder I've ever seen just hateful. And I asked Dad one day, why is that man to me? And he said, well, I mean, you know, you're having sparks thrown on you all day and hammers and, you know, so I get it. But I just want to know if they were that way your way.
I was going to, while you were talking about that, I have had a couple of experiences. You won't find a worse wrath than something as a machinist that you messed up and you got to, you know, tuck your tail between your legs, go over to the weld shop and have them build it back up for you. you're going to catch it then. yeah, caught it a time or two in the past. Hadn't had to do that kind of thing lately because we don't do a lot of that where I'm at now. But, yeah, that's a big roger on that. And back to the belt sanding of the drill bits, yeah, that was a trick that an old machinist taught me. And I seen his son kept coming over and using our belt sander, but I wasn't seeing what he was doing with it. And then me and the old man was working together one night, and we had one of the big drill bits that, you know, only one we had, and it needed to be sharpened. So he told me to go sharpen it, and I was like, we don't have a stone big enough. He's like, belt sander. What? And he took me over there and showed me one time, and I finished up, and yeah, it takes a little bit of practice. So we weren't doing it every day, but you know, you do a drill bit or two a week, and you get pretty good at it. Once you get them, get your angle, the drill point angle right, and you get them both to the same length, the cutting edge to the same length on each side. And then from there, it's just hitting them both the same. And it takes a little bit of practice, but it does a really good job. Back to you.
KL4NUE. So when I work with Dad during the summers, my favorite thing, I just remember even as, you know, being, you know, 16, 15 years old, working with Dad, my favorite thing in the workshop down there was watching that exchange between a welder and a machinist. And you're right. It's a funny thing sometimes because, you know, the welder, he's used to, you know, filling cracks in and gaps and everything else. So when the welder goes to the machinist and says, hey, put a chamfer on this piece of material for me so I can weld it up. Well, you know, the machinist says, well, you know, what kind of angle do you want? What degree? What kind of chamfer? What kind of finish? And, you know, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. And the welder don't care. He could care less. He gets frustrated because he doesn't know how to speak that kind of language, and he just says, just make it look like this. And then, on the other hand, the welder, you know, he doesn't understand thousandths of an inch half the time, and he does all his machine work with a grinder. So when it gets to the back to the machinist, it's just like, what have you done? You know, I mean, you just, you know, mess this all up, and they're just juke and jab at one another all day, and it's just the funniest thing to listen to them.
That and we're dealing with mics and calipers and stuff like that, and they're sitting over there with a tape measure and a paint, you know, a metal marker. So anyway, I'll didn't mean to cut Larry out of it. I'll toss it over back to you, and you can give it to Larry for a minute.
I'm sorry, I got wound up. Larry, you still in there, bud?
Here until the cows come home. KK4 JPQ. This kind of conversation that I can really dig, you know, really. Nothing that I ever worked with was as large as you work with every day. But being a clockmaker and a watchmaker, I worked with very small parts that whose precision was the most important thing. Otherwise, it won't keep good time, or just stop altogether. But use a lot of the same equipment with a lot of the same concerns, just under a microscope. And I just get thrilled listening to you guys talk. And, you know, like I said before, I couldn't let it go. I just had to know what the trick was. I just had visions in my head of forgetting to ask you, you know, any time in the future. I just had to squeeze that tomato right now. And that's all I've got. You all have a really good night. and the rain has stopped here finally. So the world goes on. KK4JPQ.
You don't have to go, you know, if you don't want to. But like I said, just if I stammer a little bit, just understand I'm a little tired. But I mean, I got all day to sleep tomorrow. And the things in the workshop, I probably can talk about all day, you know. That particular year, Keith, you'll enjoy this one. That particular year, her selling these was, they were going through something called lean up, which basically meant all of those parts and tools that you got rat-holed in the corner that, you know, you're not using, you know, get rid of them. But, you know, for efficiency and all that. And I just remember Dad just absolutely just raising Cain about, you know, the current had throwing this stuff away and da-da-da, this, that, and other. And, you know, some of those tools, you know, you don't use them every day, but when you gotta have it, you know, you gotta have it, that kind of thing. Well, anyway, they decided that they wasn't gonna buy these gloves anymore for the welders, and they bought Wolverines made out of pigskin, which are good gloves. They decided they was gonna hire a contractor to wash them, and you know, issue them back out to the welders. So, Dad got arguing with one another. Well, they wasn't arguing. They was just, you know, going back at one another. And one of the other welders jumped in. So they had three of them going back and forth. One of them picked the hammer up like he was going to sling the hammer out, you know, at him, hit him with a hammer. And it slipped out of his hand because the glove had, you know, had the grease and everything else on it. It had just come back from being washed. So, HRO got involved, and I just remember Dad talking about it. And, you know, the boy thought he hit the other guy with the hammer out of anger, but he didn't. It slipped out of his hands. But I just remember Dad being so tickled that, we told HRO that, you know, the reason the hammer slipped out of his hands because you having the gloves washed instead of buying new ones. So they quit that right off the bat. So I just remember him being tickled to death that they were getting new gloves again. We still got a couple of them around here that he brought home.
See that. We've done the lean thing ourselves, the plates for everything and everything in its place. And I wanted to kind of speak to you and Larry, actually. Don't know if you've ever done any of it, but Larry, we have some Swiss lathes. Done a lot of Swiss machining work, and it's still, as much as I've done of it, the smaller the parts get, the more it just tears my nerves up. I just can't imagine working on the things of your scale all the time. We have parts that we do like that, but number one, fortunately, I don't have to do those anymore. And number two, it's few and far between. We'll do big runs of them, and we're done with them for a while. So, it's pretty amazing that you can get that tight of tolerances on that piece of parts and pieces. But I do enjoy working with Swiss lathes, just not on that minuscule scale. Over.
Marvelous thing to be involved in, KK4JBQ. And I suppose, like you guys, I met one person in particular who was the most knowledgeable. I mean, you spend 2 minutes with the guy, just watching him. Maybe there's a little conversation, but there don't even need to be words. You just watch him, and you get layers and layers of respect because of, you must mention muscle memory or having done it 10,000 times or whatever, but it seems like magic almost when a real skilled watchmaker can, you're working with, you know, the metal here is gold or platinum, so everything matters, you know, everything matters. And you hold your breath. They're breathing fine, but you hold your breath while they're doing something as you watch. Going lean and that kind of thing. We had tools we made ourselves. They were particular for a job. And to clear out a watchmaker's bench of tools that he has fashioned himself to do a particular job would be a crime. And I think the guy would walk. But I'm talking, you know, a different world maybe, you know. We didn't do production things. We did specialized castings and repairs to a great extent. I remember spending weeks, going into months actually, on just setting diamonds. That's all I did. Hundreds of settings. I'll never forget the calm way my boss introduced this project to me. And he knew it was going to take months to get it finished, but he dumped out a whole tray full of diamonds and brought over sacks full of settings. And it took me a while, but I think I got to where I could do the best work I've ever done by doing it again and again and again and again. KK4JBQ.
I take it. Yeah, that tedious stuff, I can't. It tears my nerves up, especially if there's, you know, tolerance involved. Chris, he's my cousin. He's good at that little bitty stuff. I mean, he's just, you know, he's good at everything he does in the shop, but he's gunsmith, and, you know, there's a lot to, you know, some of those things, especially a, you know, old revolver or something. But I mean, he's pretty good at it, but I don't enjoy the small stuff at all. I like, you know, I got one lathe down there. It's a Royal. Pretty big machine. It loads the machine up pretty good, but I can do almost 250,000ths in a pass. If you think about that, I mean, that's because it's a circle. Actually, it's a half inch when it comes back around, I guess. But that's a lot of material for, you know, a lathe, and you get your tooling right, and, you know, I like to hear the machine work. But that little stuff, Larry, there's no way, but I don't see how you, that's just, I can't do it.
As far as like the gunsmithing stuff, and I'm assuming he's doing all this stuff manually, that's a hard no for me. I don't mind putting something on a Swiss lathe, and I don't mind even, you know, of course I'm talking programming and getting it set up and running the parts, but really what just tore me up is after you fish those little bitty parts out of the catcher in the bottom, and then it's time to measure them and make sure they're in spec. And just, you know, I've got small fingers. I'm pretty, got a pretty good manual dexterity and small fingers, and I can handle stuff like that, but it still just tears my nerves up. And I wanted to ask Larry if he's ever been exposed to an ornamental lathe And Chad, if you have not, you should look up some pictures of that kind of stuff, because that's pretty amazing. But I think maybe Larry being involved in the jewelry and the things, he may have seen one.
Maybe Q. I think I have. There wasn't much made of it because in our shop we had five jewelers, and we all shared the work, and nothing was routed to a specific jeweler. Watchmaking was different. We had this one fellow, McIntyre was his name. We called him Mac. And nobody questioned when a Rolex came in. It always went to Mac. When an all-gold watch, most marvelous thing I ever saw was a watch made from a $20 gold piece. It had been sliced so that the front of the coin was the face of the watch. The back of the coin was the back. And the movement inside was all gold as well. It was estimated at that time, and this was 25 years ago, it was about $22,000 watch. And I didn't want to hold it. That's how frightening it was. But he took it, and he was showing me, and he says, Larry, your hands are sweating. And he gave me a whole routine about not having sweaty hands, and I don't know that I could fix that, you know. But he never had to wear the little tips that watchmakers wear, because his hands were always dry. He was always calm. I think that's something you learn. But an ornamental lathe, I do think I've seen one, but I don't remember exactly. There are, for anyone else, even you guys, that would want to see something like this in action, there are marvelous YouTube videos on watchmaking, and it relaxes me to watch somebody else do this kind of work. It is another world, however, the world of the small. Now, the world of the large, you know, one of these days, Chad, you're going to have to introduce me to one of your lathes. I'll just stand there and watch. Thank you. But that would be a thrill for me, KK4JPQ.
I have, somebody make sure I got it. UE. So I have, I think three lathes down there. Two big ones. One's 18 by 40, and the other one is 14 by 40. And then I've got a little Craftsman that's, I'm not sure what size it is. It's a little bitty thing, you know, tabletop kind of. I'm just sure you couldn't do much accuracy with it, you know. Craftsman or might be a Sears and Roebuck. I don't know. It's an old machine. It works good, you know. If you want to polish something with my hand, that's about all it's good for. It's the way I'm seeing it. But anyway, I got two of those down there. One of them's a brand new machine. I ordered it 2 years ago now, I think. And you know, I'm pretty picky with that machine stuff. You know, you have to be, because, and I've got an old drill press for Dad to use. You use the drill, that's your drill press. You do what you want to do with it. But you stay off of my milling machine, because he'll run a drill bit through the part and go right into the table. And that's not a big deal for him. But I can't, no sir. You're not going to do it here. You're not going to do it here. But he gets mad at me, but hey, I can't help it. He's messing my table up. You know what I mean, Keith?
Absolutely know what you mean, yeah. you don't even want to touch the tip of an end mill on the milling table. That's supposed to stay pristine. And yeah, I guess it's the way I grew up in machining, and maybe you too, Chad, that the tiny stuff like that just tears my nerves up, because I started out, you know, I might have told this story before. We loaded 2,200-pound billets of aluminum on a five-axis gantry mill, and when we finished machining them, we had about a 65-pound part that was 10 foot long and probably 3 foot wide, and only weighed 65 pounds. We were doing wing ribs for aircraft, and moved on into defense stuff, and, you know, you know you're sending this stuff overseas for guys at various locations around the world, and so I guess what I'm saying is we put a lot of pride in all of that stuff, you know, from aircraft wings, because you're flying people through the sky, and then troops all over the world using your equipment to, you know, basically survive with. So, but yeah, it was always big stuff, mostly big stuff, and get down to that small scale, and it just, yeah, I can do it, but I sure don't like it over.
I know what you mean. Years ago, Keith, I ran into some kind of situation. When tractor restoration was big years ago, I've got six, seven old tractors down here that I've restored three of them, you know, spent a lot of time restoring them. The others were just kind of waiting to be restored, never did, but I totally lost my train of thought, Keith. I'm sorry, it totally slipped. It'll catch up with me here in just a minute. Go ahead, and Larry. Let me get my thoughts straight. I'm so sorry. I know that's happened to y'all before, but go ahead, Larry. I'll pick it up.
Just the tone of the conversation, but yes, that's happened to me. I've been walking in the direction that I needed to go to do something, and in mid-stride, it just flies out of my head, and I don't know why I'm going where I'm going. That sounds crazy, but and it's not old age catching up. It's not bad. It's, you know, well, it could be that you're tired. Yeah, you've already cautioned us that your tired is showing. So don't think anything of it. It's happened to all of us. KK4JBQ.
I got it. Let me make sure I got it, Keith. Years ago, I ran into a situation, you know, some of that older stuff you can't get parts for. So I got into casting, you know, making molds and, you know, melting aluminum to pour into a casting. I made some brass castings, bronze, a lot of aluminum castings. Now, I'm not good at it at all, you know, not like a, I'm not sure, a die maker, but people that make castings, there's a name for it. I can't remember what it is, but I mean, I can make a rudimentary part, you know. You can always make it oversized and then, you know, machine it down. I think that's the intent. But I have casted some parts and have been successful with it, you know. There's, you know, usually some inclusions or voids that, you know, have incurred. But that's always been very interesting. I've got two forges down there that I use to melt whatever. And I usually like the, you know, these older engines. Usually keep the pistons out of them because I don't know what it is about that older aluminum. It has a tendency to not have as many voids in it when you try to cast something with it. But I thoroughly enjoy that. I don't know if y'all do any casting up there or not, Keith, but I got fairly good at it.
Do not, and that's always been a fascinating aspect of the business that I've never done much of. I've worked with a lot of casting, and I've worked with some casting companies that were just phenomenal. You know, and then you get a hold of another casting company that we used to have a running joke that you're trying to drill into half a part, you run into a car bumper along the way. So it was always those kinds of challenges. But then other casting houses we used, it just amazes me the consistently very high quality work that they turn out. So yeah. Hats off to you if you're casting your own part. That's definitely a science and an art.
Got it. KO4NUE. Clarify this now. I just won't be straight up honest and say I was fairly good at it. I am by no means a master at all. I can pour some kind of rudimentary something. You know, we usually make a copy of the part, and we had a casting company here in Greer. Father and son owned it, and it was the office looking building you've ever seen. You know, half of it didn't have a roof on it and that kind of thing. But I asked him if he would teach me. You know, help me get started. So he eventually told me how to make the green sand. He wasn't keen on it at first because, you know, the green sand that holds the casting, that's pretty critical because if you can't split the mold, you know, you can't get the part out or make a copy of it. But he taught me a lot. And one thing that I've never realized was that, you know, usually with a part that's in a casting, it's always got some kind of taper on it. And that taper is so you can get it out of the green sand, you know, and make a copy of it. But once I learned that you need to find to put a taper on everything somehow, you know, I started getting pretty successful at it. But it took a lot to figure it out, you know. But like I said, I'm not masterful at it. I can do something rudimentary, but that's okay too.
That's a step ahead of where I'm at, so hats off to you, that's for sure. Go ahead, Larry.
That's interesting, Chad. I don't know that I've done any casting like that. All the casting with jewelry is done with lost wax. Well, most of it is. And on a centrifuge. So the sprue, which is the thing that holds all the pieces, that usually are the same. Every single one is a copy of the other. You know, and you're using precious metals, so everything is saved. The sprue, of course, is reused. But that's true with most casting. I think no matter the metal, you just use the metal over again. But, yeah, that's that can, you can get great detail with that. You're always going to have to clean up a casting, but that's the only kind I've done. Sand casting is another fine art. I've watched some films on sand casting, large bells, and small hand bells also. That was quite interesting, using sand casting. So I'm just going to sit back here and listen. I'm getting educated all the way around, KK4JBQ.
Had a flashback of sand casting we did in industrial arts in high school back in the 70s. And we, I don't know if you remember, like the old Rio Grande fences, like they're used to sell, they'd have a little shepherd or a retriever or something on top of the gate. And we did some sand castings and did a bunch of those different various animals and such as that. And that's the last time I did any sand casting of them.
Well, like I said, that's not something I do every day because it takes a lot of setup. I've got 3 5-gallon buckets down there that's full of my green sand. You know, keep a lid on it so it didn't get contaminated. And the way I was taught, you just pour it all, clean the concrete floor, clean it really well with a broom or a mop or whatnot, and you just pour that out on the floor, and you just take a hose pipe and wet it down and mix it with a shovel till you get it, the sand where it'll stay together when you compact it or squeeze it with your hand. Because you can't have too much moisture in it, because when you pour your metal in it, that steam is going to probably distort the part or create an inclusion or whatnot, but the object is to get it to stick together without a whole lot of moisture. And then, making the mold boxes, that's always been, a little bit of a challenge. Finally figured out how to get the tapers and the tangs right. So when the box goes on, it goes on exactly the way it came off. And that's harder to do than you think. But I had a bunch of swedge lock fittings, brass fittings over the years that, Dad's brought home from work or whatnot. Lifted those down to make some small stuff, I can't do anything big, but I've been able to do brass and bronze, but just what I got just will not get hot enough to do steel. I mean, that takes a lot of energy to do that, and I've never been able to get that hot, but I can deal with brass, which is not bad.
If I had the equipment and talk to it, I would probably do a bunch of brass ornamental type stuff. Don't know that I would have a need for functional parts, but I would love to do ornamental stuff like that.
I haven't got into ornamental. That stuff is pretty difficult to do. Ornamental means tedious, that kind of thing. But that's just something rough that I can, halfway machine. And I typically, though, I'm so bad at it, let me tell you, especially with brass. I always hit some kind of inclusion when you're machining, for a seal or whatnot. And I don't think I've ever been able to cast one that was inclusion free. And I'll have to go in there with a brazing rod and, you know, fill it back up and, you know, machine it down. But, I mean, that's part of it. But that portion of it I never was able to really figure out. I've tried borax. I've tried, you know, flux. And I just, you know, was, you know, not able to ever do it. But, I can do something for a tractor, not an aircraft.
Roger that. The fact that you could take a bunch of, you know, like you said, scrap fittings and stuff like that, if nothing else, make you a little piece of bar stock to work out of is good enough for me. I've got into 3D printing stuff, and that always intrigued me is, that way you could pull whatever out of your head and make a reverse out of it. And I was thinking not only like sand casting like that, but also silicone molds and beefier plastics to get more robust parts, that kind of thing. So, anyway, I don't have anything else tonight, guys, so I'll take a standby and y'all carry on as long as you'd like. Enjoyed it, and we'll have to get together again like this. KN4CHY, I'll be clear and listening. Back to the group.
23 Keys, have a nice evening, sir. And Larry, you go ahead and pick it up.
Listening. Keith, you have a good night, won't you? And this has been a pleasure. I thank you for jumping in there. Strangely, the thing that jumped into my mind, talking about castings, was mascots for the hood of an automobile. And then it struck me, are there any tractors? You were talking about show tractors and collect vintage tractors and things like that. Has any tractor you've ever seen had back where I grew up, they call them hood ornaments. They're actually known as mascots. On the nose of a tractor.
What down here is called a badge, BADGE. And I think there's quite a few that have a badge on the left and right. But the first one that pops into my mind is the one tractor that has, actual ornament. A Canadian tractor called Cockshut and Minneapolis Moline. The Molines have got a big M and M for Minneapolis Moline on the hood. And amazing tractors, just kind of powerful, whatever size they built. That's, to answer your question, that's the one I know of.
And for DJC.
Great tonight, sir.
I did pretty good. I was just listening to you guys earlier, and that energy when Larry was mentioning about, when you're talking about castings, and Keith, if you're still listening, I hope you have a good evening, too. I've got a friend of mine that he's actually a knife maker now. He makes slip joint knives and does a beautiful job. His name is Paul Mason, and Paul, I think he's retired now, but at one time he did he did all the casting and metal work for the hood ornaments, for Rolls and for Bentley as well. And I've seen some of his work in his gorgeous. I'm not sure how he does it, but it is an extremely detailed process. He was one of maybe three or four people that did it for years and years. And like I said, I don't think he does it anymore, but it was really interesting seeing what all he had to go through to get it done. And, of course, they're not as elaborate now, I don't guess, as they were back when Rolls and Bentley were in their heyday. But I thought I'd interject that. But I've been around, you know, casting for, you know, big machinery type casting. Chad and the West Point Fire, they just had a huge warehouse looking thing where they had the sand and these wooden bowls for casting, some of the castings. And this huge floor of sand that they put the wood, you know, do the wood mold on one side and the other and do it that way. But it's been 30 years since I've seen it. You guys carry on. I just wanted to interject that about the casting and the ornaments and that sort of thing. Import EJC.
What, Chad? Wow. Make sure I got it. Things started up here again. It's pouring down rainy. I wondered if I brought up hood ornaments, mascots, badges, if some comment like that would come out of the airways. Someone is acquainted with someone who worked for Rose and Bentley making their mascots. Over in Great Britain, they call them mascots for sure. Well, that just makes my skin stand up. But casting can, you know, it is the beginning of a really finally finished piece. It is just the beginning. There's lots of finish that goes on to little pieces like that. But I just wonder if there's any money in it, you know? If you had a notion to do something like that on a limited basis, talking to you, Chad, on a limited basis, if there'd be any, you know, interest in the general public anymore, you know? I don't know. But things that are in the past, some of them will never come back, you know? But I can still respect the skill, the craftsmanship, the artistry even, of people who have come before us. I have a great deal of respect and good memories of McDonough. I'll never forget that man and the things that he could seemingly do so easy. I know you stood beside people, maybe your dad, Chad, and you admired how it came so easy to him once you took up the tool yourself. KK4JBQ.
UE. Well, no, Larry, I'd have to disagree. I'd say initially for me, it's always been a struggle, you know, with my hands when I was younger. But I always had that desire to do it. You know, I'm going to do this, and I've got to, you know, I've got to practice. You know, Dad started me out welding on a MIG machine. And, you know, Dad always says, you know, even a monkey can MIG weld. And, you know, but I worked all summer with him MIG welding, you know, this or that, and process, you know, production stuff out here in the shop. And then, you know, it came time to, you know, start stick welding. I had an awful time. I mean, an awful time with it. And I'm still not, I mean, I'm not good at all. I'm a rod burner, is what you would call, you know. But it took me forever to get coordinated enough to, you know, feed and speed and how you, you know, put the rod in there. But I'll feed the puddle. And Dad just, I mean, he's always got that magic touch. But it didn't come easy, Larry. It nothing has come easy, you know, for me. It's always a major learning curve.
say. Chad is that way with almost all of us. The exceptional person hatches out and is able to do anything, or so it seems. And we can stand back and admire them, but skill is a learned thing. And unfortunately, it takes time, it takes material, because just a few mess up, some of that's not recoverable. and the time, especially if you're working for somebody else, the time is not recoverable. But one thing you have to learn along the way is the risk for all of those things, the material, the time. But if you're working, and you know this very well, if you're working with a customer's object, if it's a small thing or a very large thing, there are considerations above and beyond just making it work, just getting it to look good. In the case of jewelry, some of those things you can put into words, but every case is a different case. I've had customers across the counter just argue with me that I switched their stone. I took in a $30,000 diamond, and I'm giving them back something worth half as much. Well, no. And we learned, even while I was there, we learned to document, take on the take-in. Now, it was easy with a small piece, and you probably don't have that problem because how unique the individual pieces are that you work on. But the pieces we worked on were not that unique. Diamonds may be rare, but they're everywhere. You know, consider that. De Beers would not, these are people who are diamond brokers. De Beers would have you believe that diamonds are so rare and so valuable. Well, the big ones and the clean ones are. But, you know, let's face it, they're in practically every engagement ring on every female, on every married female. So what's so rare about that? And if you work with something, even though it be expensive to afford as an individual piece, if they're passing through, if, you know, dozens of them pass through your hands every day, it becomes a different thing. I've got a different outlook on jewelry than anybody else I know. KK4JBQ.
Well, I don't, like I said, I don't do much with jewelry or things like that, just that old tiny stuff. I don't do it, but I do remember being younger, and still today, as a matter of fact, to be able to watch somebody that's skilled with, you know, what they do, that amazes me. And, you know, like Keith was talking about, you know, sharpening drill bits or this, that, and the other, there's always something there that you're not seeing. What you're seeing happening is the muscle memory. It's not the connection between his brain and hands that you're able to see. But when you get older and you realize that there's something that you need to be thinking about when you watch him work, that I remember that was taught. My dad taught me to do that, or tried. And as I got older, I filled in the gaps. But I remember distinctly how Dad started me off, and it was, I won't ever forget it. Here, and you watch what I'm doing. But I want you to be good enough to watch what I'm doing, and I want you to know what I'm going to need next, and I want you to have it ready for me. So if he was, you know, cutting a board, you're going to need a pencil, a square, and a saw. Well, when he's got the pencil in his hand, I need to be offering the square. And when he's got the square in his hands, I need to be offering the saw. That's how he started me. And it was brutal, you know, but it was the right thing to do. I mean, that was my starting point. I won't ever forget it, you know. And I'm 50 years old, and I still do it for him, which is what I should do.